Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. My pleasure today to introduce Professor Amadeo Arena from Naples. He's associate professor at the University of Naples, Federico II, which is already much right there. And he's an expert in European Union law and international law, and has degrees from King's College London and New York University, as well as from obviously from Italy. And he's been also a visiting professor at the University of Tokyo. So, well-travelled, come over here and come to the UK for a number of different events. And he's going to talk to us about the doctrine of preemption. And so will give us some insights into the interplay of powers between the Union and its member states. So, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Bell. Thanks for your kind invitation. I'm really glad to be back in Cambridge. Last time I was here was for the Cambridge International Comparative Law Journal Conference, so it's really nice to be back. The university was established more or less at the same time as Federico II. Federico II is from 1224, Cambridge is more or less the same period, and our Wi-Fi system also is from 1224 sometimes. The subject of today's talk is something I've been working on for the last 10 years, so I really hope I can keep it within 30 minutes. In case I'm not able, please let me know, and which is the subject of preemption. And what is preemption? Well, there are many definitions as preemption as there are authors who wrote on the subject, unfortunately, especially when it comes to EU preemption. So the best thing I can do is to give my own definition of preemption, which is a theory of normative conflicts. Essentially, preemption tells us when EU law is in conflict with national law. And why is that important? So that primacy can apply to solve the conflict in favor of EU law. And since member states are required to abstain from adopting any measure that conflicts with EU law, preemption becomes an indicator of the residual lawmaking and treaty-making power that member states have. Now, this doctrine is never explicitly endorsed by the Court of Justice. If you look for preemption on the Court of Justice website, you only find reference to the right of preemption of shareholders, which is quite another thing. But a few advocate generals since 2009, so since 10 years ago, have been using this term as referring to the interplay between national and EU law. And you see there are few of them, of course. Many of them are not necessarily with the same meaning and the same definition. So again, there's a bit of an uncertainty there. So you might be wondering, as the guy over there, but why do we need a theory of preemption? So we managed to live well so far, so without a theory of preemption, then why do we need one? Well, I don't know if that's relevant at all, but other federal systems, they do have a theory of normative conflict. For example, the US has it, Canada has it, Australia has it, even the Andean community has it, which is, for several respects, a copycat of the European Union, and yet they have a theory of preemption, and we don't. Also, and it may be argued that the lack of an equivalent theory of a theory of normative conflict in the EU makes the application of the doctrine of primacy somehow somewhat unpredictable, and also that makes determining the actual residual powers of the member states difficult to determine. The competence catalogue, of course, but it only provides a static picture. As Lucia Serena Rossi, the Italian judge at the ECJ, said, if you really want to know what are the residual powers of member states at a given time in history, then you have to look at the acquis. The real catalogue is the acquis, because the boundaries continuously shifting, of course, in favor of the EU. Okay, so let's look at other examples of theories of normative conflict. Well, of course, the greatest source of inspiration was the American one, although I'm not advocating, of course, a legal transplant there. So in the US, they have an express supremacy clause, as you know, and then the Supreme Court developed over time, took about 100 years, to develop a doctrine of federal preemption. Its classic version emerged at the beginning of the 20th century. was something called latent exclusivity. So the existence of federal legislation in an area was the evidence that the area was preempted, so it was an exclusive competence of the federal government. The modern version is a little bit more complicated, and well, it's clearly codified in Gade or in Rice. So essentially, it starts from a presumption that Congress did not preempt state legislation. So presumption against preemption, unless there is a clear statement of the Congress to preempt, so express preemption, or preemption can be implied, and that can be inferred, so the intention to preempt state legislation can be inferred from the occupation by the federal legislature of the entire legislative field. And that, for example, is the outcome of finding that federal legislation is very pervasive in that area. Or that there is a conflict, like a rule preemption or obstacle preemption. So there is a conflict between federal law and state law. You cannot comply with both at the same time. Or at least that state law somehow constitutes an obstacle to the attainment of the goals of the federal legislature. Then in Canada, instead, they have paramountcy. So they don't have separate doctrine, although even in the US, they are separate, but not as separate as Robert Schutzer, for example, would like to think, or I would like to think. Americans, they often consider preemption and supremacy more or less quite the same thing. In Canada, there is no separate name, at least, for that, so it's paramountcy. And the test to they have to determine whether there is a conflict, of course, one of these tests is the occupation of the field, so similar to the American field preemption test, although it's not that popular anymore, because in the paramountcy trilogy of 2015, the Supreme Court of Canada, you can see in the picture there, endorsed a two-branch test that revolves around an operational conflict, so you cannot comply with both again, or the frustration of purpose, so very similar to obstacle preemption. Then in Australia, we have an express supremacy clause in the Constitution, and three tests to determine whether that clause applies. So covering the field, again, similar to field preemption, or conferred rights test. So is one level of legislation try to take away rights that have been conferred by another level of government? And also the simultaneous obedience test. So is it possible to comply with two sets of legislation at the same time or not? And even the Andean community has developed some kind of similar concept. So they have developed the concept of primacy, preeminencia, and the relevant judgments that they really resemble the ECJ judgments. They even cite the ECJ judgments. And then they have this preemption andina. And so some of the notions that they have developed are the ones of complemento indispensable. So the idea that if Andean law governs a certain field, then states, nations can only adopt provisions that are indispensable to complement Andean legislation. If instead Andean legislation does not control, does not occupy the field, then there can be some desarrollo legislativo ulterior, you know, some further legislative development or of the matter concerned. What about the unpredictability of preemption? Well, Wilson was the case that got me hooked on this very topic. And this is why I'm here, by the way, why I wrote on this subject. So the case revolved on concern of this British barrister who wanted to practice in Luxembourg under Directive 98.5 under his own title. So as you know, the requirement is to register with the local bar, and the local bar proceeds to registration upon receipt of a certificate that you are a qualified lawyer in any member state. That's all the directive says. However, when Mr. Bilson applied for registration, he was asked to pass a language proficiency test in French, okay, not too difficult, German, well, maybe if your English is a bit easier than if you're Italian, and Luxembourgish. That's quite a tough one, considering that it's not taught in schools, you know, so it's a language that only happy few speak. Of course, Wilson is a lawyer, so he refused to take this test. He challenged then the decision not to register him before administrative courts in Luxembourg and not the Bar Council judicial section. And well, he eventually, the Court of Justice said that Wilson was right, because even though the directive doesn't prohibit member states from introducing language tests, doesn't say anything in that respect, it carried out a complete harmonization of the entry requirement. And so the certificate attesting that you're a lawyer in another member state is the only requirement upon which the exercises of the rights granted by the directive can be made conditional upon. So how do we account that on the basis of the current framework? Is that the case of primacy? So was there a conflict? Well, there is no provision, no express provision of the directive that has been violated. So unless we have a very broad understanding of conflict and primacy, is that really primacy? Or maybe is that the case of the effect of the shared competence mechanism under Article 2, Paragraph 2, that member states can only exercise shared competences to the extent they have not been exercised by the EU? All right, that could work, possibly an alternative with the other one explanation, with the other explanation. But then what about Protocol 25 that says that when EU law legislates in a field, then the preemptive effect does not cover the whole field, but only the specific aspects regulated by the EU, and the EU did not expressly regulate the aspect of language tests. So how do we account for that? Also considering that even after the Lisbon Treaty, there have been cases such as Meloni, Plus, and so on and so forth, of complete harmonization of occupation of the field, which seems to contradict Protocol 25. And then we have other provisions there in the treaties that seem to rule out preemption. Say, they say that the exercise of EU competences, of certain types of EU competences, such as complementary competences, does not deprive member states of the right to exercise their own. So does that rule out preemption? Really? Does it? I don't know. And what about, I love this book about Klamert. He says that pretty much everything can be accounted by the principle of loyalty, notably the negative aspect of loyalty. So, which of the three? I would say all of them. Can we really exclude one of them? You know, this is a bit of an aporia of the current system. And also, the way the court looks at cases, you know, is not that schematic. So the court does not say, oh, this is a shared competence. So first of all, we have to rule on the application of Article 2, Paragraph 2, Paragraph 2 of the TFEU to see if there has been preemption. Then we have to look at legislative conflicts. You know, it is a bit of a more fluid kind of examination that the court carries out. What about a priori exclusivity? So a priori exclusivity cases should be a no-brainer. We have a common commercial policy, we have a national measure. It's a no-brainer, it's preempted. A member state could not legislate in that area. And yet the court does something different when those cases arise. The court looks for EU legislation adopted in the area of exclusive competences and looks for conflicts between EU legislation and the national measure. Why? That seems unnecessary. Probably, I would submit, because it is easier to establish a conflict between an EU item of legislation and a national measure than to determine the boundaries of the exclusive competences, which can be quite elusive. But still, isn't that a little bit strange? It sits uncomfortably with the existing theoretical framework. And how come then a specific authorization in EU legislation can untrigger the exclusivity effect? Is it constitutionally tenable that something happening at the legislative level can affect a constitutional kind of exclusivity or preemption? And what about, or again, can we say that this kind of preemption that takes place in a priori exclusive competence is not also a violation of Article 2, Paragraph 1 in conjunction with Article 3, Paragraph 1, the competence catalog? So isn't there also a violation of a specific treaty rule when we have a national measure impinging upon a measure, an exclusive competence area? And again, is the duty to abstain from legislating in exclusive areas, is it not the negative aspect of loyalty, again? And what about ERTA? It's even more difficult to conceptualize under the current framework. How do we account for that? Is it the effect of the primacy of the affected common rules? So in a way, the treaty is contrary to the existing common rules because they are affected, and so the common rules preempt the treaty. So it seems like a reversible effect. If you repeal the internal legislation, then member states can act in the external sphere again. Or is it an exclusive competence with a movable boundary? So it is an irreversible effect. So even if you repeal legislation, then the competence has become exclusive and there is no provision to make it shared again. And again, is it constitutionally tenable that something like the constitutional exclusivity can be based on a legislative trigger? Or again, is loyalty, again, the reason loyalty was especially mentioned in ERTA. So again, loyalty purpose also has a role to play. Well, the way I look at it, of course, it looks different than the way I prepared. The why was supposed to be up there, but it always happens, you know, with the slides. So what I suggest is a sort of grand unification theory, so not to form like a strong interaction on electromagnetic power, but in a way a theory that can encapsulate all the three sources of preclusion of duty of abstention on the part of member states, so exclusivity, primacy, and loyalty. And this theory is really based on an inductive reasoning from the ECJ case law. So it looks what really happens, not what is supposed to happen, which is the top-down approach that somehow is espoused by the competence theory. No? This is an exclusive competence, so things should be that way. Now, this theory instead is based on what the Court of Justice does. And also, the advantage of it is that it enables comparisons and shows common patterns between preclusion in various domains, because it enables comparison of preclusion happening in the ERTA sphere and in the internal sphere. For example, it is widely accepted that the same item of legislation has a broader external preemptive effect than it has an internal preemptive effect. Now, if we use a legislative instrument to account for internal preemption and a competence-based argument to account for the external preemption, we cannot really make this comparison. They are two different theories, so you cannot really quantify and compare. If instead you use the same theory, although with variance, at least you can quantify and account for the differences and similarities. So these are the sources of preemption, let's put it this way, the conflict constellations that can take place. Of course, there can be others, but these are the main ones. So constitutional preemption, conflicts between EU primary law, including the Charter, and member states' internal and external acts, including interstate agreements. ERTA preemption, this particular case of EU internal acts conflicting or interacting with a member state's external acts, including interstate agreements. And finally, legislative preemption, so EU internal and external acts, so even international agreements concluded by the EU, versus internal unilateral acts of member states, including member states' constitutions, by the way. So how does the theory work? And I'm afraid it's a little bit even more complicated than that, so let's try to walk through it. So this is the pattern that I think recurs in all three cases. So in constitutional, ERTA, and legislative preemption, we more or less observe the same type of reasoning. So first of all, the court engages in a scope overlap test. It looks at whether the EU norm and the national norm have the same scope, if that scope overlaps to a bit or doesn't overlap at all. If it doesn't overlap, then no brainer, there is no preemption. So we end up in the green box over there, end of the story. Then if instead the outcome is positive or quasi-positive in ERTA preemption cases, as we will see, the court either carries out the field preemption test, field preemption analysis, or conflict preemption analysis, or sometimes both. So we actually need more arrows over there, but so just take my word for it, and let's suppose that the court only takes one test. So in the case, again, of field preemption, if it concerns the area that is affected by EU law. Please remember that this can be at the legislative ERTA or constitutional level. And the court looks for certain features of this area that warrant the finding that there is a sort of an abstract conflict triggering preemption. If this is not there, it's still possible to establish preemption on the basis of a conflict. So the idea that the two norms somehow cannot be complied with at the same time, or at least that one precludes the attainment of the objectives pursued by the other. So this also can justify preemption, as you see, with the bottom arrow over there. So let's have a closer look at what I think is the most common kind of preemption, which is legislative preemption. So the first clear-cut legislative preemption case is even earlier than Costa, it's the Unger case, where the Court of Justice said that there was this regulation number 3 on social security, and the Court of Justice ruled that member states are not required to make the rights granted by regulation conditional upon additional requirements than those laid down in the regulation. So a kind of field preemption, if you wish. So this is the overview. Of course, slides look different than they should. So first of all, the scope overlap test. The outcome can be positive or negative. Then field preemption analysis. And so we have a positive finding of field preemption in case the EU legislation or EU item at issue is exhaustive, which is synonymous with complete harmonization, is the character of EU legislation. But instead, field preemption is ruled out by a finding of minimum harmonization or partial harmonization. And then we have conflict preemption, which can be established on the basis of rule preemption, so a conflict, outright conflict between two norms, or obstacle preemption, a conflict between the goal pursued at the EU level and the national norm. So, scope overlap test. Only the Court of Justice usually only provides or reports the negative outcomes of this test. The positive outcomes are usually not reported because the negative outcomes are conclusive. The positive outcomes are just the beginning of the flowchart over there. And it's very important in field preemption cases. So we have some examples. In Sindhu, for example, there was an overlap. In Amsterdam Bulb, instead, there was no overlap, so no preemption. And then what about field preemption? It is exhaustiveness, the exhaustive pervasive character of EU law that grants this finding. For example, in Wilson, the court found that this directive had completely harmonized the entry requirements and also that the absence of prior test was somehow compensated by other arrangements designed to protect consumers and the administration of justice. It also happened in the field of human rights. For example, in Meloni, the court found that the European arrest warrant framework decision had carried out an exhaustive, I would say, the court said so in subsequent judgments, harmonization of the condition of execution of a warrant in the event of a conviction rendered in absentia. So member states could not make surrender conditional upon further requirements because that would undermine the protection standard struck at the EU level, which reflected the consensus of all the member states. Minimum harmonization, Hans Honig is a classic case, dealt with the size of hen cages. So this directive only set the minimum size. It means that member states could require larger cages for hens. Or Sky Italia, a little bit with a twist. So according to this directive, the Television Without Frontiers directive, which has recently been amended in the Visual Media Services directive and then recently amended again, you can only have 12 minutes of advertising per hour. But the directive also enabled member states to lay down stricter requirements, and Italy took advantage of it by requiring pay TV operators to have less advertising than normal, than free-to-air operators. So harmonization can also be used this way. Partial harmonization, D'Agostini, for example, is a case. Again, this directive on Television Without Frontiers only partially harmonized television advertising. This means that member states can regulate deceptive advertising on every other mean. What about the type of act? Is the fact that the act is a directive or a regulation indicative of its preemptive effects? Well, it seems so. Regulations seem to be more preemptive than directives that should leave the choice of form and means to the states. Turns out it's not so. So it's not. We cannot really tell from the beginning and establish a clear correspondence. What about ERTA preemption? Well, here's the overview again. The scope of a lab test is a little bit more complicated. We can have this kind of spurious outcomes. In the case of field preemption, we have three factors warranting field preemption. And by the way, this explains why preemption in external sphere cuts deeper than in the internal sphere, where we only have one factor, which is exhaustiveness. So in addition to exhaustiveness, we have the scope alteration, so the ability of the international agreement to affect the scope of rules, and the presence of provisions relating to third countries. And then we have conflict preemption, but I have to say this is quite rare. I've seen just a few instances of them. Let's just see a few examples. So for example, the scope of a lab test, as I said, has a spurious outcomes. So for example, the famous largely covered quasi-positive outcome that also can warrant the finding of preemption, or quasi-negative outcome. For example, the agreement only covers a very small part of the EU common rules, as in the Cartagena protocol case. Non-member state, third country provisions, this is usually referred as the WTO doctrine. It's currently codified in Article 3, Paragraph 2, first part. And I think this case, preemption was already in ERTA, because in ERTA the relevant regulation refer to empower the Council to negotiate agreements with third countries. So it was already there. Scope alteration, the idea that the agreement may alter the scope of the common rules, that's what happened in the opinion 103 on the Lugano Convention, which, as you would see, would extend the scope of certain recognition mechanisms beyond the EU. So even without there being conflict, this would alter the scope of some EU rules. Or exhaustiveness, so that was the case, for example, in opinion 291, because there were very detailed rules on the labeling of dangerous substances, just warranting a finding of preemption of an agreement in that respect. But in that case, the court also found that other parts of the ILO convention were compatible with the existing legislation, because they only imposed minimum standards, and also EU legislation only imposed minimum standards, so there was no possible contradiction between the two. It was a race to the top, which is the goal of both kind of minimum requirements. Or this has been generalized in Max Planck, then in the field of environment, there's generally no preemption, it's generally a shared competence. Partial harmonization, we have in opinion 194, for example, that the legislature only achieved partial harmonization of the sectors falling within the scope of the TRIPS agreement. And then we have rule preemption and obstacle preemption, but as I said, there are just a few cases referring to them. One of them is Green Network, for example. What about constitutional preemption? Well, this is the overview. So in this case, the factor warranting field preemption is not the exhaustiveness of the existing EU regulation, but the exclusive nature of the powers granted to EU institutions, which doesn't presuppose the existence of some EU regulation, because this is at the constitutional level, so rules are pretty generic. And also the negative factors are different, the delegation and the implementation doctrine. So the scope overlap test, of course, is very complicated in at the constitutional level, because provisions are very broad, because derogations can be broad too. In Commission versus Latvia, for example, there are like 20 paragraphs on the derogation for public servants, and just two paragraphs on the actual conflict between freedom of establishment and the nationality requirements for notaries. And also, how do you define exclusive competencies for the CCP? Oh, it's been controverted, of course, has used very different approaches. So, you know, in this depiction over there of Rotko, that's not how competence really look like. It's a bit of a simplification we like to think about, but in reality, things are not that clear-cut. What about the exclusive power? Well, there is an exhaustive list in Article 3, Paragraph 1 of exclusive competencies, but also from ACMEA, we learned that Article 344 and 276, they can also justify a finding of exclusivity in a particular field, the powers of the Court of Justice. Also, I noticed that when the Court of Justice declares a certain area as an exclusive competence, it usually does when there is already a little bit of regulation in that area. The Court has horror vacui, so it's well aware and afraid of legal gaps, so tends to only declare exclusive competences where there have been some kind of harmonization. It's also interesting that the Court prefers to, in these cases, to rely on conflict preemption analysis. So, for example, in AG2R, for example, instead of ruling that the measures, national measures concern the field of competition just impinged upon an area of exclusive competence, that would have been a no-brainer, end of the story, the Court prefer to find a conflict with Article 101 and 102 of the treaty. Or in VEBIC, the provisions were also held to be incompatible with Regulation 1/2003. Again, I think it's easier for the Court of Justice to find conflicts between actual provisions rather than fields, which are broadly defined and their boundaries are difficult to define. Delegation doctrine, so a specific authorization can enable member state action in an area of exclusive competence. Some scholars say that this is the case of the stricter competition rules on unilateral conduct, which are allowed under Article 3, Paragraph 2 of Regulation 1/2003. What I found surprising is that these constitutional exclusivity, the a priori exclusivity, can be derogated by way of a relatively implied specific authorization found in legislation. There was the case of bulk oil, there was the case of Pansar. Also, the implementation, it seems that it is in line with the general power of implementation that member states have. Member states can also adopt implementation acts in the field of exclusive competencies. And what is the notion of implementation here? Is it as broad as the France implementation notion or not? And then, of course, we also have rule and obstacle preemption when it comes to conflicts with the treaties. Rule preemption is quite common, possibly because the primary law provisions are very broad, so they catch a lot of national measures. Think about the breadth of the Dustin-Deal formula after Cassis de Dijon, or Krauss, for example, the restrictions approach. And also the obstacle preemption is quite common as an approach is used to prevent circumvention of the letter, the wording of the treaty. So a bit sometimes it overlaps with the effetto til kind of criterion in Gibeino and Luisi e Carbone. Anyway, let's jump to the conclusions. So what I think are the advantages of establishing this new theory, which as we've seen is not entirely new, it increases the predictability of the Court of Justice case law. Now, in the US, they have preemption, and there, of course, preemption is not an exact science, but at least it makes the decision of lower courts and of the Supreme Court to some extent more predictable, because there are clear patterns to understand whether there is a conflict or there is no conflict between federal and state legislation. Also, it increases the transparency in the EU legislative process. So when the member states adopted Directive 98/5, were they aware that they couldn't introduce language requirements, or were they not? Well, with the theory of preemption, at least they would have asked the question to the Commission, and maybe the commission would have found it necessary to specify that in the Commission proposal. It also increased confidence in the implementation of EU law, because at the moment, you know, you implement EU law in a way you think is complying with EU law, but then the Court of Justice said that the areas feel preempted, so it turns out that all your additional requirements were discussed in the case of bread, for example, in Italy, vegetal carbon that is used to make black bread apparently was incompatible with EU law. So if preemption is a thing, then it's easier to spot in advance this kind of cases of bad implementation. But I think most importantly, preemption enables a more constructive debate on member states' regulatory autonomy. In Italy, we were concerned by judgment in the Court of Justice in the Taricco case concerning criminal limitation periods and the retroactivity of the modification of that. We were really not happy about that, and all Italian lawyers, scholarly commentators, they said that there should be a limit on primacy. So they attacked the general principle of primacy, which I think holds together the whole European system. Instead, they could just have said, and which is what the Court of Justice did in the MAS ruling, that there was no problem with primacy there, primacy did not apply, because there was no conflict. So it was a preemption aspect. There was no conflict because limitation period had not been harmonized yet, and it was a shared competence. So member states could still regulate the matter of limitation periods as they felt necessary. So that's similar to what happens in soccer. If you get a yellow card, what do? You challenge the authority of the referee to give yellow cards? Just say there was no foul, or maybe that the foul doesn't deserve a yellow card. That's the same with primacy. When you get the judgment you don't like, you don't just challenge the principle of primacy, which can be a problem, especially because you set a bad example for other member states. You just say that maybe, in your opinion, there was no conflict warranting the application of primacy. So it is a preemption problem. And on the basis of the theory of preemption, this can be debated. There are categories that can be used to make arguments in favor or against preemption in a given case. And also, so far I described preemption as it is, as it can be inferred from the ECJ judgments. It doesn't mean that that's the best possible preemption doctrine that we have here. And I think some tweaks, for example, could make it better. For example, we could give some meaning to the difference between directives and regulations by establishing a presumption against preemption in the case of directives, or in the case of certain competencies, such as complementary competencies or other competencies where the treaties seem to rule out preemption, so to give some meaning to the provisions of the drafters. And also we could establish a clear statement or clear form requirement. So, for example, the idea that if the EU legislature wants to preempt national regulation in a given area, it has to do so expressly, so that member states are aware of that when they pass legislation, or possibly that they have to do that with the regulation. So linking the effect of a given form to the given effect on the division of the vertical division of powers. Anyway, if you like the show, there's going to be a book I'm writing on this subject, which is going to be published in 2 years, hoping I can meet the deadline. And this is my favorite slide, my hometown of Naples.